This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 007. I did think of finding a FinTech invoice company and calling this one 007, a license to bill. However, I've gone one better than that. On the show today, I'm delighted to welcome Special Agent Mike Nolte. The real 007, that is if you can call a fictional character real, had many missions and came through them all alive. Michael has had many missions, and I'm glad to say has survived them all so far. His missions have been as varied as 007's. Michael is a fellow of the Royal Society, and he's currently founder and MD of Third Sector Finance, which adapts financial services products to meet the needs of social enterprises in the UK. I met him at a digital currency day, as he is both an investor in digital currencies, as well as utilising the blockchain. He's a non-executive director of Naratus, a company in Swaziland in the renewable alternative fuel sector. In the Second Gulf War, he co-founded a company that became very active in supplying satellite communications. I could go on, but I think you get the drift. In a world where words get devalued big time, Michael is a real entrepreneur with a capital R and a capital E. I thought it would help not just the fintech community, but also the broader creative and entrepreneurial folks who also tune into this show to hear some lessons from someone who can seemingly turn his hand to anything. Furthermore, one of his core experiences, which may well help shed light on the current fintech boom slash bubble, is none of the above incarnations I mentioned just now, but those coming from the dot-com bubble time. In those days, Michael founded a number of companies, as well as being an active business angel and investing in a whole bunch of internet technology companies, most of which, but not all, went through the roof and then, as happened back then, back through the floor on the way down. From those times, Michael has learned a whole bunch of lessons, not least of which that after his success with the ones that went through the roof and stayed up there, or at least cashed out, he retired to France for 18 months and had plenty of time to consider the lessons he learnt, as well as plenty of time to do those things that all of those who have never retired for 18 months want to do, which is have a nice time, and then actually what happens is one gets bored and goes back to being too busy again. So, let's get on with the show. Hi, Michael. Thanks for joining me today.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
So, when you were at school, Michael, what did you want to be when you grew up? Did you want to be a special agent, and how did you go from those days to having this hugely varied career, given what we were just talking about before? I just need to add that I only just scratched the surface with some of these things.
Well, first thing I really wanted to do, which was sort of education-oriented, was to become an architect, a creative architect. You're doing
most architects aren't creative, of course, these days.
Exactly. That's why I didn't get onto a course.
And I say that as my friend Mikel, who is an architect, is an avid listener to the show.
So that was, I didn't get in, so I ended up going to art college instead.
And what do you mean by creative architect then, joking apart?
Joking apart? Well, when I went for the interviews, most of the interviews were how good was I at maths, because a lot of my time would be spent calculating ducting flows.
Right, it's all the process kind of stuff.
It's the stuff that sucks the crap away.
Yeah. I lived in Bath for a period of time, and one of the things that struck me from Bath, which has been a metaphor for many things, of which all professions are one, is that these great Georgian crescents look wonderful at the front, but if you go around the back, it's all sort of the bricks equivalent of sticky back plastic and sellotape, keeping it all together, and looks pretty crappy.
That's right. The things I liked were what they're building now, you know. So at that time, you can understand, because it didn't have computers. It was all sort of drawing boards. And it was tricky to do something like Le Corbusier would produce a beautiful schematic, which was easy to understand. But once you got into more natural forms, which is the sort of thing I was wanting to do, you couldn't almost design the things on any scale.
So you must be a fan of Gaudi and Barcelona, no?
Absolutely, yeah.
Even if they never quite finish the Sagrada Familia?
Well, I prefer some of the smaller houses.
Yeah.
You know, as you wander around, you find them around the street corner, and there were some Gaudi lookalikes as well, which I also think were pretty good.
Gaudi is one of those things, actually, that I'd seen pictures in books, oh, I know what Gaudi looks like. But somehow it's only when you're there in the presence of the building.
Absolutely.
That you really get sort of a contact with that. So you wanted to be a creative architect, but you found that the average architectural job wasn't that creative. So then did you decide to become special agent and do a million things, or did it just happen one after another after another? Or have you got a low boredom threshold, or just a Midas touch?
The key for that was reading Henry Miller.
I bought a book by Henry Miller once. I never managed to read it.
Oh,
you must be sort of smarter than I am.
Oh, I'm not sure about that. It was just an osmosis, probably. But what it was, the message was, if you really want to understand something, you have to go and do it. So that took me into all sorts of interesting corners of the world. And very often it's absolutely true. If you want to know about running a business in the Isle of Man, the only way to find out about running businesses in the Isle of Man is to go and run a business in the Isle of Man. And I'd recommend running businesses in the Isle of Man. It's great fun.
The weather's not so good, but I know what you mean. I was talking to a number of people today about doing the podcast. I almost launched a podcast a couple of years ago on more alternative, healthy type topics.
Well, it's the community. It's a friendly small business community. Very often it's the community that makes the business interesting.
Yes, that's certainly true, hanging out with the right people. But my point was that quite often you know things in advance, but it's only by doing them that you experience what it's like. So, for example, you think, oh, she's a very nice girl, or he's a very nice boy, then you get married, and then 20 years later you've got more of an idea what it's like. Or, oh, children seem a good idea, and then like 15 years later you've got a different perspective of it. Or coming back to the podcast, I thought, oh, a podcast seems a good idea, and my current feeling is a bit like I'm on a steam train that's going on a circular track. So I keep the speed up, but I've got to keep shoveling the coal into the fire.
Keep it going.
And I keep going past the same stations over and over again.
Well, fairly early, I learned the basics in the Isle of Man, where I actually had a sort of a general painting decorating business, which I sort of set up, because no one else was doing it.
Right. That's a seminal experience.
Fairly straightforward, not difficult. So I was taking on these contracts of renovating old houses into flats, that type of thing. Quite mundane stuff, but I did learn the trick was to employ good people and, you know, pay them X amount and then bill X plus Y. And that type of business is pure capitalism. I didn't realise at the time. But it's a very good understanding for how that sort of thing ticks.
Flattery aside, there aren't many people that one meets who've done loads of different entrepreneurial things. But when I do meet them, I think the commonality is that they've always managed to cut through to the simplicity of, actually, it's really quite simple. And if I compare them to entrepreneurial people with a small e, who are doing all sorts of complex things, all sorts of buzzwords and all sorts of...
I'd agree. One of the things I found there was we did quite a lot of work for... This is gardening work, so right. A fairly general thing, for millionaires who were buying houses there. And we did work for 6 millionaires, it's just a small team. And I got to sort of do the bullshit job. Now, that was quite interesting because 5 out of the 6 were really nice people. And I'm thinking, okay, you hear these stories about millionaires being nice people, and it's not true. And I was trying to wonder, well, why are these nice people millionaires? And you get to know a little bit of the backstory. In the end, I sort of came up with a peculiar conclusion that the one thing they had in common was they were all divinely stupid.
Keep it simple, stupid, as Clinton said. Could have been elected twice.
Absolutely. So this is, it's like the simplicity of the thing.
It
really drives it forward. They did have that ability to sort of just cut through the undergrowth and actually see this is what the business is about.
Yeah, I was talking to a very intelligent fintech person recently who's got all sorts of degrees and background and city background. And I was really talking to him about the benefits of tomato sellers. You know, there is something that you learn by being a kid, well, I guess it used to be 11 or 15, you leave school and you go and sell tomatoes on your barrow. You learn something about business from that, which goes into your bones, that you can't learn by any amount of...
No.
Complexity.
Yeah. I mean, the market trading, I know a few friends of mine who have done well, are doing well, happily. Two of them came from market, you know, learnt the business in the market.
Especially if you've got something like tomatoes that are going to sort of die by tomorrow and you can't really sell them. You know, you sell them, you make a profit, as you say. Moving more on to the investment lessons, and we'll come on in a little bit to the fintech scene. One of the things that I've quoted you to many people that I've met over the past couple of months, and they've all told me, oh, you must get him on the show. So you are on the show. And I'm probably about to find out that I actually made up this point or I completely misunderstood it and misquoted you, was in terms of when you were spending your time sitting in a nice French garden, your reflections on kind of the businesses that worked out well versus those that worked out well and then crashed down. And the way I'd put it in my language was that, oh yeah, I met this guy and the main lesson he learnt was that all the businesses were kind of doing what they did well. Let's use the word content, but not in the sort of modern use of the word content. They were doing what they did well, so just imagine a small circle. And actually, generally, that wasn't the thing that led to success or failure. What led to success or failure was the context. So imagine a much wider circle of stuff they weren't focusing their attention on. And it was whether the stuff in the bigger circle was aligned that led to it.
Yes.
Now, everyone loves that point. It may not be the point you made, but or you probably put it more eloquently than
it's,
that.
It's a point that, probably, I know. It's you're doing what you think is right.
Yeah, you're focusing on what you're focusing. I'm looking forward. I can see what's in front
hopefully,
of me.
Hopefully, and you have to do that. Yeah. You can't not focus on getting this one thing running. When you work with people, you're always looking for people who are very focused on, you know, getting to a certain point. Yeah. Whatever that is, different reasons. But then there's all sorts of the other world around you, because you have to interact. If you're going for investment, you've got VCs, business angels, lawyers, loads of different types of advisor, you know, people you meet at the pub, quite useful. And there's all of that, and it's a case of very often people almost as a gestalt, a horrible old word, but good. People may form an opinion of you, and they form an opinion that that business is worth being in. Or they've just had an opinion made for them that, well, this is the type of business we want to invest in. And then they haven't got one of their own, and you walk in the door with one that they think, ah, that looks pretty well like the other one. I don't think very often there's a great, it's a decision-making is quite emotional. So they want to find that pattern, because very often, certainly from investors, they tend to look for something that's anyway, it's established and doing something. But also they've seen something successful in the past or currently that they can latch on to. You know, there's a herd instinct, there really is. So it's all of that going on around you. But rules and regulations changing.
Yeah, but that's quite hard for the average tech person to deal with, who's a good developer and sitting at their computer and has developed something that's good, because they're not used to going out doing song and dances.
No. I mean, the one certainly, if we were going to be eventually to in fintech especially, is compliance. Now, there's very little done on compliance side in that. And of course, the whole compliance thing is getting tighter and bigger. And that's big in big business stuff. So, yeah, that is going to impinge on a lot of the new technologies, or already is. And how that works is that you've got to be canny. It's essential. Team's important. Groups of friends are very important. And so you get sort of someone who's, you know, you've got the guy who's driving it, but then you need people also in the team who are aware of the other things going on.
Yes, it's the team is a really key thing. I mean, I've been talking to a number of people recently, and my perception of the fintech scene in London at the moment is that there are a number of people who are now perfectly capable of taking a good idea and turning into a good product. And there are relatively, relatively few people yet who've gone through the phase of turning a good product into a good business. And that's largely because the people who've got from good idea to good product don't have the kind of 360-degree vision, for the sake of argument, or more 360-degree experience to enable them to sort of put all the bits together that makes a business as opposed to just a product.
Yeah. I've met recently some amazingly talented people. I mean, they really are good. And, you know, and good people, great ideas. That's part of the equation. Another part of the equation is and I want to be optimistic, are the incubators that's appearing. Certainly around London, we've got a lot of these incubators coming
up. I'm on
up.
The cynical side of this one.
So. I'm cautious. That sort of theoretically bridges that gap. But it bridges the gap because what they're doing is they're selective. So someone else from outside is then, look, I have this wonderful product and it will do this. And then they look at it and they say, well, that's great, it's fantastic, but no one will ever buy it, which is a fairly common mistake entrepreneurs make. So what they do is the view. So my sort of line would be then you need to find those skills. I mean, whatever you do, the biggest mistake any entrepreneur can make, and I've made this a couple of times myself, is to actually come up with a wonderful idea that you're convinced everybody wants to buy. And in fact, when you get there's only a few, and mostly it's your own family.
You believed your own propaganda.
Friends. Yes.
Yes, I mean, I think on the incubators thing, I mean, I was discussing this with Eddie George a couple of episodes ago, and I think it's just a question of this sort of whole bubble at the moment. So there's like dozens and dozens and dozens of incubators around, and of course, Darwinian evolution will weed out some that actually do that job very well. You know, a lot of them don't necessarily do it very well. And I just remember reading this morning on the interweb an article by a chap in America who had actually done a study of accelerators.
Oh, interesting.
And found out the ROI and the numbers that are paid back. This is in America, where the whole phenomenon has been going much longer. Oh, and it was something like two or three. It was the ones you can name off the top of your head, like Y Combinator, Techstars, and whatever, Startup Bootcamp, and that was kind of it. And all the rest hadn't. Hmm. So, you know, the incubators I've been seeing, a number of them are basically just providing you with an office, and they try and get some great and the good to come in and give some free mentoring by way of the added value. And then a number of them run a sort of program for 3 months or something like that. But then, you know, is that enough to turn it into a business?
If incubators are run properly, they'll be looking to bring in projects, ideas that could be turned into a commercial reality.
Yeah, and I think they are. If they're trying to do that.
Yeah. But then what you're saying is that they're failing because they're not. Either they're not getting the candidates coming through the door or they're picking the wrong candidates.
Just to be clear, this is just my feeling, you know, as a former investment guy, that if you put in front of me the, let's say, the names of the 20 incubators in London, and you wanted me to say succeed, fail, succeed, fail, I'd probably put fail against most of them.
Right.
However, I think some of them will succeed very well. And I think part of the thing is that we haven't actually had many companies in London go through the whole process. There are some well-known companies out there that have raised 25, 40, 60 million and are doing really well. They've turned into a proper company.
Mm.
But that's relatively limited. And in terms of the incubator point you're saying, and why I'm a bit suspicious of some of them, a lot of people don't have, in my opinion, enough domain expertise of financial services. So I went to an incubator recently, and I saw their 10, and a lot of them were quite young, and they didn't have experience in financial services. So if I was going to get my money out of my own pocket and put it on them, I wouldn't. What I've liked is the people who haven't gone to incubators because they don't believe in 15 grand is enough for 8%, but somebody I meet and they say, I was at JP Morgan for 15 years in this area, I know all about it, I know all the people. I know what the problem is, I'm going there to solve it. And I think those kind of fintechs are just, I've met in my experience, a lot of those are more middle-aged, they don't go through the incubators. And I've discussed this before, but I think one of the implicit things about lifting incubators over from Silicon Valley to here is that it clearly worked over there. But I haven't seen any critical assessment of the fact that in Silicon Valley, one reason they worked is that Silicon Valley has got very retail, very B2C kind of culture. 17-year-old on a sofa knows what another 17-year-old on a sofa wants. A 17-year-old on the sofa doesn't have the domain expertise to attack compliance in financial services. Come back to your example.
Well, one of the things from sitting in the garden with the, under the tree with a glass of white wine, which I did occasionally, in the summer anyway.
Red wine in the winter.
Or cocoa. Cocoa. It's too bloody cold.
Do you ever go back to France these days, or did you...
Oh, yeah, I love France.
Oh, right, you love France.
I love the country.
So I misquoted it, actually, because the story's much better. If I say, and after 18 months, this guy couldn't stand France anymore, never went back there again.
Oh, well,
I embellished it somewhat just to make it
better. Well, that's reason. Hey, you know what? No, but one thing I did sort of think through, if you actually look at businesses, and you sort of score the maximum, which is like most likely to succeed, the ones I've came across over time were the ones that were effectively a management buyout. On a scale of 100% success and zero, the ones that stood the most chance of success were the management buyouts.
Right.
You get a big news organisation who have a shows section, you know, and they decide that they're going to get rid of the exhibitions.
Yeah.
So they then get rid of that. What they effectively do is they offer the management of the exhibitions division a chance to take over. Now, assuming that they're entrepreneurial, they take over an existing business with a bunch of customers that they can then bring in the much better expertise because they own it and take it. That's 100% chance of success, definitely. Then you work through variations of how much knowledge people have.
Mm.
And obviously the zero end is someone who has a wonderful idea and maybe the technology knowledge to put it together, but with no one's interested in it.
Yeah.
And it's somewhere in that spectrum that you're going to find people who will have part of the idea, like you're saying, people coming out or from experience.
Coming from the industry.
From the industry.
Rather than from the sofa or from a university.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is one of the points, I was kind of slightly joking, but I think one of the challenges isn't the incubators or them themselves, it's the fintech area. Fintech is very specialist. So to give a simple example, well, no one would imagine that you could set up a biotech company without knowing a hell of a lot about biotech.
You know? Absolutely.
You and I would go and buy some test tubes. Oh, we've got a great idea for a new drug. We've never done it before. Everyone laugh, you know, you laugh. But funnily enough, you hear that in financial services quite a lot. And I think one of the reasons is that the low-hanging fruit of financial services is very simple, allegedly, like foreign exchange.
Yeah.
Because we all know how to do that.
Yes.
But actually, the vast majority of financial services is more like biotech.
Yeah.
You need to have been there for 10 years.
That's it. And people also, I think, make a mistake in fintech of, I mean, certainly from the startup side, of looking at the retail banking, which is only a small part of overall financial services. You then look at the rest of it, and it's very specialised.
And
there's no
M&A
way.
M&A boutiques, hedge fund.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's treasury management. Yeah. You know, now what does a treasury manager need as a set of tools?
Yeah.
It's doable, but you have to really understand what a treasury manager person does. And if you don't have that knowledge, you blindfold.
Yes. So in terms of sort of pulling these things together, if you were going to set up your incubator tomorrow, or if you're going to go back to being an angel investor, and let's say you're going to do it 100% of your time, full time, what are the sort of key factors that you'd be looking for?
Well, I tend to go, as in one of your previous podcasts, if I was investing the route as an angel, you're already looking for existing successful businesses that need some cash for different reasons, and not cash to pay debt. you know, cash to build.
So basically not early stage VC.
No. That's a very difficult area.
Yeah.
And that's where you, I mean, if you offer somebody a desk and only take 8% from them, that's quite a decent deal. Because one of the other things, when you do start businesses up, you actually need a good environment. Mm-hmm. And I think 8% is a good deal for that. Because very often, you know, I mean, I've seen too many people in the back bedroom or in a tiny little centre where they're sitting next to someone who does a plumbing business on one side and a carpentry firm on the other, and they're trying to set up a high-tech business, which is where I've been at one point.
Yeah,
and they don't get the buzz.
And it's also the Rolodex. Any incubator has got a good Rolodex of content.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's up to you, as the guy setting up the business, to get that Rolodex active. There's the anecdote on Iraq. I mean, we got a call from one of the non-military security firms, just a general inquiry because from the website. And that came through. That was fine. You know, what did they want? Went to meet them. Suddenly realised there was quite a big business going on here. There's a lot of these, you know, sort of non-military stuff was going out there. So again, the entrepreneurial tricks is you tend to be quite proactive and pick up lots of knowledge that people would think useless, but these tend to be useful. So for different reasons, I actually understood how the Foreign Office desks worked. So each country has a desk. So I just phoned up the Iraq desk and explained what we were doing.
And you had a comms business before then?
Yes, we were developing stuff and selling other people's products. So I phoned them up and got through to the Iraq desk. And I said, we're doing this for XYZ company. And we'd like to do it for the other British companies, being a British firm.
British.
So I got the list of 12 I'd been vetted. Then, of course, I just got on the phone and we picked up another 4 of them. That's how it worked.
So going back to keep it simple, stupid.
Well,
you have the chutzpah to do it,
and the
experience to be able to deliver it with credibility,
which
is very important, and you just get on and do it. I heard a story similar in a way to keep it simple, stupid today, where somebody was telling about a friend of his who had a very good startup, blah, 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 just like all the others. And this guy raised 400 grand, which is more than nothing. And I said, oh, how long did that take him? Thinking of the timescales of all the other people who'd raised about 400 grand. And the guy said, 8 hours.
That was good.
Yeah, exactly. So that's precise. Well, I said, that's not bad. But again, you know, if you have the right phone numbers from your incubator or from wherever, and you've got a good idea, and you're putting it simply and clearly like you do, then sometimes you find you push on the door and the door's open in life.
It is surprising.
Plenty of time, this is my life, plenty of time I'm pushing on something, and after a while I realise it's a wall and it's not meant to open.
I have a rule, which I often break. If you're going to start something, you give it 3 months. If you're not getting traction after 3 months, you really have to say, is it worthwhile? Because usually within 3 months, you know that it's working or not, or you've got the feel.
I wonder whether that should apply to relationships as well. Or maybe that's a sort of off. That's the X-rated version of the London FinTech podcast. Well, actually, there aren't many women on the London FinTech scene anyway, actually, so there's a slight challenge there on that front.
Oh, I think the women I've met in the FinTech scene are amazingly bright.
Yes, exactly. And they're amazingly wise because they go to somewhere where there's about 30 ratio of men to women, or certainly the sort of tech drinks that I've been to.
Yeah.
So I like the idea of the 3 months thing. And of course, I completely buy into understanding the market and understanding where there's demand and testing it.
Mm-hmm. Also, you look at an ethos and you're looking at FinTech. I know there's a lot of work. I mean, I've been making the phone calls. Certainly around the...
Making phone calls is a good point, though, actually, because, you know, we kind of grew up in that era, but modern people don't. They text each other, email. It's not the same.
Not the same. It's
different. Not the same.
It's different.
And so many people just don't make the phone calls.
Mm.
I know that myself. Sometimes I go through periods where I'm a bit lazy. I'll send emails out. But it's not as good as picking up, hi, Michael, how are you doing? We'd like to win the show, yes, no, okay, done. Right, as opposed to pinging people emails and thinking, I must chase them 2 weeks later and, you know.
Yeah. No, I prefer, I mean, it's a really good substitute for face-to-face, which is also a very good way of doing it. But, yeah, I mean, you can find out with a few phone calls what the FCA's thinking. You know, I mean, where they're going. Because, I mean, there's a lot of innovation coming out of the Bank of England at the minute. And they've all got all of these new sort of innovation in finance things coming up.
Well, it's interesting.
And just lining with that, because that the investors are watching that. Yeah, and if you come forward with your wonderful idea, or even if it's just at startup stage, then you think, we have something that fixes that FCA problem. Then they're going to go, seriously? And you may start a wonderful relationship.
There's a book which has some really good stuff in it. I don't completely recommend it, but it's on a Kindle. I say it's a good book, but it just kind of wanders around a bit. By a guy called Marcello Bravo, who did start a whole bunch of biotech companies around Oxford. I think he's from Peru originally. And he got some background in something like Unilever or some huge company like that who really market tests anything before going to market. What he says, his idea of a good startup is one, where the market will pay you now to create the thing that you're going to create.
That's reasonable.
Validated startup, he calls it. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
I come to you and say, Michael, if I can give you this at Christmas, you know, will you pay me a couple of grand for it? Oh, absolutely, mate. You know, yeah. Do you know what? I'll give you a grand now. And that's what he says is a good startup.
You've got to have a need.
Yeah, a validated need as well.
Yeah, there's got to be a need there. Yeah, and also that you said a very important thing, they're testing. I mean, one of the great ways of not wasting your money is test.
Yeah.
You know, because you've got the technology, will it work, will it not? I mean, okay, you then calculate risk. But then is there a real market for it? You've got to test it. Is it real? The advice you're getting from people, test it. I mean, I've dealt with experts all my life, you know, and it's one of the things is none of them ever quite agree with each other. So you have to make your own mind up.
Well, this is where it comes into it. So I kind of agree, of course, and I spend a lot of my time telling people about the difference between product push and demand pull businesses and saying I'd much rather be in a demand pull.
Absolutely.
One of the problems is, though, that mantras get taken too literally. And after a while, let's say we're trying to stand up straight, but we're all leaning to the left. So some bloke's going around, lean a bit more to the right. But after a while, you find some people who are lying on the floor on the right. They've taken it to an extreme.
Yes.
You know? At which point, you need the antithesis. So I was somewhere recently, trendily dressed as always, wearing a Motorhead T-shirt, and I quoted Lemmy from his autobiography, just play your music, yeah? From almost like an artistic perspective, and Seth Godin likes comparing art and business, do your creative thing, you know? Play your music the way you want to play. Eventually, this is a different paradigm, of course, but eventually, your audience will find you.
Yeah.
So I came back to feedback. One reason it might go wrong, you're in a group of 12 people, you go around and ask everybody what kind of music they want, and you kind of try to aim in the middle, you're going to produce lift music. It's going to be SH1T.
Yeah.
So I'm just making the point there that, of course, while agreeing with you, a lot of people can hear what we say and then just take this and end up lying on the right on the floor rather than standing up straight. Rather than balancing, hey, look, this is what I'm quite good at, and this is what I kind of think, and this is my take on the world, and some experts agree and some disagree, with too much feedback. The other thing that does my head in about this whole feedbacky thing, he says, getting into a sort of minor soapbox thing, is what it's done to politics in the UK. All this focus group-driven stuff. You end up chasing your own tail in tiny, tiny circles and going nowhere.
Well, I love focus groups.
Do you? Oh, fantastic.
I adore them.
Well, let's have an argument about focus groups.
Yeah, I know, it's good. I mean, I'd love to get a focus group of six top financial people, people who actually own the businesses, who's responsible for getting the quarterly figures up each quarter. Right. Let's have a focus group of six of these and look at things like, you know, we're getting very much involved in blockchain and near-money issues now. What do they want? Can you imagine what would come out from that focus group?
So it's
you know?
Well, I've got a couple of observations, as always. may or may not be of any use whatsoever, but if in doubt, keep talking. It's always been my mantra. So that used to exist in the past, and it was called the gentlemen's clubs.
Oh.
So when it was merchant banks and all that kind of stuff, the chaps did get together, or weekend aristocratic house parties, and sit around the same table. So they're not using the focus group, but there was that conversation.
I'd like to be behind the mirror, watching the camera.
I'd probably be sort of downstairs polishing the shoes, actually. But so there was that paradigm in the past, which did happen when the city was a network, or with stockbrokers or stock jobbers, and the much more niche, speciated stuff that they kind of manage their affairs much better. I suspect the problem these days is knowing some people that have got the challenge of managing these vast organisations. If you're managing an organisation of 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 people, you don't have a millisecond to consider the content of your million type of conglomerate businesses. So they're just much more professional managers of vast organisations. So I think a focus group of those, you're not really going to be getting the people at the coalface.
So we go for the middle ground. Who's going to be in this focus group we're going to build?
I'm arguing for the sort of the more visionary stuff. I'm arguing that
we've got plenty of visionaries. We've got the visionaries sitting outside.
That's a good point, actually. In a prior episode, which I haven't released yet, a very good guy who's in charge of innovation at Direct Line Insurance, it will have been released by the time people are listening to this one, makes the point to me, and he's done lots of innovation departments in large organisations, that the last thing you want to be in one of those is a visionary, because they're blue sky thinkers, and they're just floating off. No, you want to actually produce stuff and get it out there and see whether it works. So you want to keep away from the visionaries. However, my point is more on the fintech scene, that actually there are a bunch of folks trying to do something differently, whether it's TransferWise, whether it's Open Gamma with risk platforms, whether it's the peer-to-peer crowdfunding sites. I think those are the guys who are driving the change, and my perception, rightly or wrongly, is that senior management of banks are reacting slowly in a slightly panicky way to that. They are not at the moment driving the change, although for the last 30 years in financial services, most of the time, the banks were driving the change. massive changes. Having joined pre-Big Bang, you go through Big Bang, and then you get all the merchant banks are bought by the commercial banks, and you get sort of various booms and busts, and then da-di-da-di-da-di. So the banks have driven the agenda most of the time, but it's almost like they're just sort of exhausted in these vast conglomerates which need to be broken up.
I mean, the banks are only part of the financial services.
Exactly, insurance companies.
We've got the insurance, we've got the pensions, I'd include the whole nine yards. Yeah. You were talking about disruptive, you know, technologies like peer-to-peer lending. Now, there are issues around that when it touches ground, like there is all with all fintech, because of compliance issues. So we come back to this old compliance beast, you know, which is, you know, the elephant in the room very often. You know, and trying to fix that. So it's almost like you build your business having analysed the compliance issues, and then your business comes out from fixing that compliance issue.
Yes, and that becomes circular. So again, that's a problem for the T-shirts and also for the suits. So over here, we like to think of America as a place. But you go to America and you find there's a whole bunch of states, and each state you've got to get your money transferred. Yada, 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 yada. Whoa! So that's even more than in Europe. So pulling this together, Michael, as time shoots by, and I'm very happy for you to have your own opinion on things. I mean, you know,
you're not always right. I appreciate that. I am the guest here today.
Yeah. Well, absolutely, yes, I just do too soon to forget that. But one of the reasons, actually, I like the fintech scene at the moment, which is its early stages, is that reasonable men can differ quite a lot. It doesn't actually matter, because do you know what? We'll find out tomorrow, or if not tomorrow, the week after. And before we know it, there have been a dozen incubators that have been incredibly successful.
There's definitely people you meet, there's the sort of revolutionary feeling out there.
Yes, there's real change, and then people trying to make a difference and trying to put the bits of Lego together, and it's not quite working. So that's what makes it interesting, because it's not a question of anybody can be right or can be wrong. There's all these things swirling around. And that leads us quite nicely, just to wrap up in the last few minutes. Where do you see the fintech scene going in London the next few years? I mean, you've got this very grounded background in terms of you were very active creating companies and investing companies in this vast boom around the year 2000, and a lot of people in fintech were probably sort of in short trousers still in those days. From your experience in terms of what's similar and what's different this time around in the fintech boom in London compared to the dot-coms, what's your personal feeling about where it's all going?
Well, it's going to be different again. I mean, you can't assume, because it's going to be the same. That's part of where the humans assume things are going to stay the same. It won't be. It'll be different. It's quite a profound change that we're looking at. If it's what I think it is, it will change the world of banking and financial services forever. We will still have banks and that sort of thing, but the way they operate, essentially with blockchain and similar technologies, I always use the word philosophy there, that will bring in some new, horrible American word, paradigms, but certainly new ways of understanding what we need to do with our financial services. And we make them hopefully more customer-centric, rather than investor-centric. You know, that would be nice. The technologies, I mean, this is technology-driven at the minute. I mean, I'm a great fan of Ethereum, and I quite like the way they're doing it. They've fixed all of the Bitcoin issues, as it appears at the moment, and they've got some good strategies, and they are somewhat aware of what I've seen of the compliance issues. You know, for instance, they were talking about locating in Switzerland. Probably better off going to Texas, There are other reasons not to go to Texas. So I think it's a difficult one to call. Again, it's going to be testing. And I do like this. One thing, a big lesson I've learned, is test and test and test. If you find that something is the right place in the right time, and that's luck, suddenly there'll be one, two, three big, big changes. And that'll drag the rest of it behind it. I mean, what happened with the dot-com, which actually more of an internet boom, there was a whole pile of money spent on companies that didn't go anywhere, ridiculous things. But behind that, there was a lot of good businesses and new technologies that came out, certainly on how to transmit data. They pushed the limits of technology at the time as far as possible, and that did fix a lot of problems. So that's why we today have cable in our homes, which is unthinkable at the time. But you know, that one of the technology movements did bring that forward. And it's difficult to predict what would come out from this in 30 years hence, which I'm looking forward to seeing. But we will see, you know. And it's certainly something around the blockchain world is changing things.
So bringing it all full circle, going back to the architecture point, one of the interesting things about what you say, and I think the same about blockchain and some of these other technologies, is that the glamorous thing is always the front of your Georgian crescent.
Exactly.
But the thing that abides is actually, electric lighting, or oh, gas in the houses, oh, an indoors toilet. That kind of thing persists.
Yes, I mean, it's what people need. I mean, I love the idea of the unmet need. And
I have lots of those, but that's another story.
Well, it's the ones we don't know about. Very interesting.
No, indeed. Okay, thank you for that, Michael. The time's gone very fast. I think there's lots of sort of points in there that people can pick out. I mean, I think the one that just resonates with me quite a lot, because sometimes I do it, and when I do it, it works well, and sometimes I get lazy, and when I don't, it doesn't work so well, is to just pick up the phone and make a few calls.
Absolutely.
Again, keep it simple, stupid. Do something like that.
People make the world go round or something.
Yeah, yeah, do something like that, guys and listeners, and just try it once. Just try an afternoon, just calling
off.
Well,
we've got meetups now. They're fantastic.
Yeah, that's true.
That works. That worked very well.
That's true. Well, I should give a shout out for Eddie George at New Finance, where we met in the first place.
Yes, absolutely. And go to your nearest meetup.
Absolutely. Good. Well, thank you very much for that, Michael.
Very well. Welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight dance.